Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, I'm very well. The sun's out. Things looking up.
Yes, they are. I'm very excited about Richard.
I know. As well as a proggy, you're an old fogey, aren't you?
I just went everywhere. I was just, you know, I just sort of ended up getting into all kinds of music as a kid, and definitely Fairport was on my vinyl list.
No, they absolutely were, and it was very prevalent, wasn't it? It was just kind of very much around. Although I remember I remember one of the first singles I ever bought was Gaudete by Steel Ice Band.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. It was probably shunned by most serious folk.
Yeah, absolutely. But, that was bubblegum for, even though it was actually in Latin.
I went to a grammar school and I was invited to join the Morris dancing group that was a sort of, you know, post-school group that had got together with a bunch of kids and the economics teacher. But I didn't go the full bells. I didn't do it. But you're...
Yeah, I joined the Morrissey dancing troupe instead, where you just had to wave tulips around.
That you may hear later about my, you know, influences in the folk music.
I'm sure. Anyway... Yes, so let's get him on. Mr. Richard Thompson, welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune, for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
I've listened to a few of them, and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hello, Gary. How you doing?
Hello, Richard.
Hello. This is nice.
This is very nice. Looks very cosy where you are. Lots of posters.
Cosy. It's the sort of the junk room, really. We're just redecorating. I've been slapping a few coats on and...
you do it yourself?
Of course. Proper bloke, you know.
Have you moved back to London?
I've always kept a place here. So, you know, the plan is to spend more time here now because I sort of miss it and I love being here. So I have to work in America, you know, quite a lot. But this always feels like home to me.
Where was your pandemic, though?
Mostly in New Jersey. Which is, you know, not the most exciting place to be locked down, I suppose. But one got by.
Did it inspire any writing? I mean, it's I can't think of it. It's a fantastic folky thing to write about. It's some great plague.
Well, yeah. I mean, I did a lot of writing. Nothing about lockdown at all. It's just a nice to be able to have all that time, you know, without other things to distract you. And I wrote a lot of stuff, but it was mostly just coming out of my imagination. It was nothing really about, you know, being in prison or anything, you know, or being in the middle of a sort of bubonic lockdown.
You went to live in America quite a while ago now. You sort of Americanized yourself. It's nice to have you back.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. What part of London are you from, Gary?
I grew up in Islington on Essex Road.
Essex Road, of course, yeah.
I went to a school called Dame Alice Owens, which is you may have heard of, I don't know, it's the grammar school up at the Angel.
I think we played you at rugby, didn't we?
I definitely wasn't playing at rugby at any given time at that school. Well, I'm doodling on my guitar.
That would have been a bombshell.
But basically I'm back. I've got a place in Hampstead that I've had for before, when it was affordable, about 35 years now. So in spite of all my peregrinations, that does feel like home.
And the book's been so well received. I mean, Guy and I have loved it. We've been talking.
Bless you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
And you never thought, probably, when that young man was, that shy young man was going to be talking about his life endlessly, all these years later.
And is the reason for that the fact that it sort of basically ends at 75, and then we get this thumbnail sketch of everything since then, does that mean there is going to be a volume two? Or?
Well, I really don't know. I stopped in 75 because musically I kind of stopped for a year and I ran an antique shop.
I love that.
It was hard to see, where music was heading at that point. My audience had kind of frittered away a bit, and it wasn't until punk came along that simultaneously helped to destroy the rest of my audience and also inspire me to think.
I was going to say that because that's something that comes up in your book, which I thought was really nice, which is that as opposed to a lot of your contemporaries, even though because you were that sort of crucial few years younger, but you saw punk as a thing of hope rather than...
Well, it was a re-energizing of the music scene. I mean, music in the 70s was sort of glam rock, metal, prog rock, none of which I really cared for. And I couldn't really see where I was going except maybe back to the folk clubs or something. I couldn't see the future, but punk was this real... reconnecting with the basic roots of rock and roll. It was like Sun Records or something like that, a bit cruder, I suppose, but it had the same energy.
When you had the Clash doing the English Civil War,
fantastic, then you had the Pogues doing that, the folk version of punk. So it was, for me, it was like a signpost really to get back out there.
Well, I suppose there is a connection with folk in that it was, English kids singing about political issues of their time, about not having work. I mean, there was a sort of sense of post-industrial revolution lyric.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely correct. And I think music has always spoken to those issues, especially music of the underclass, the working class, whatever you want to call it. So that would have been called folk music, traditional music. And with punk, it was the same thing. It was supposedly working class kids expressing, their frustration at, at the world, Thatcherite Britain.
A lot of what you were saying earlier about music you didn't care for, actually, funnily enough, punk is as well, had a theatrical element to it.
Yeah.
Mm. It was about the performance, which is something, growing up, even though I loved your records, I could see there was a complete shyness about performance with Fairport and with the folk scene. Maybe later with Steel Eye Span, there was an element of that thrown in, which is kind of ironic, isn't it? Because you think folk music, with Morris dancing and that sort of dressing up that went on. You've always shied away from the idea of a performance for you. It's been about the music.
I think that came more out of Fairport being a band around the London underground scene, the psychedelic scene in sort of 67, where it wasn't that visual really. It was mostly about the music. Pink Floyd at that point were just a band of fairly faceless people, but behind a light show, behind all the bubbles and ripples of a light show. So Soft Machine, but people like that. Mm-hmm. Arthur Brown was more theatrical, but most bands around that scene would have said, it's a bit distasteful. You're pushing yourself a bit too much if you have any kind of theatricality. And I mean, the reality about traditional singers is that they were theatrical. They get up in the pub and they use lots of gestures. They kind of sell the song. In that sense, I think if we were shy, then it's because we were shy people. Mm. If we thought a bit more about it, if we had more of a visual sense, then I think we would have turned to that a bit more. But I think we just passed us by, really.
But it's funny because you talk about being shy before, and that thing of being shy as a performer, but you're. Mm. From listening to all your live stuff and from when I saw you at the Festival Hall, 2010. In fact, we briefly met backstage.
Meltdown, yeah.
And you are really, really particularly good at bantering with your audience. So you do actually really have that talent of connection.
Yeah. As soon as I started playing like solo acoustic, mostly as a way of paying the rent, actually, as a necessity. I was opening for bands like Crowded House, on these huge North American tours. And Crowded House's audience were like 13, 14. I'm thinking, shit. I'm going on like naked solo in front of all these kids, mostly girls, you know. So I thought, right, I'm going to attack the audience. I'm going to borrow, you know, the personas of a couple of musicians I know. I'll borrow Danny Thompson's persona. I'll borrow Pat Donaldson's persona, you know, sort of loud, aggressive people. And I'll just harangue the audience. I'll just shout at them and I'll get on top of them. Because otherwise I'm just going to die. And it actually worked. So I'd end up with getting some nice applause from these, you know, 13-year-old girls. Thank you very much. And and it kind of stayed with me. And then I started to feel very comfortable on stage as a solo performer. And I found it very easy to have a kind of a dialogue with the audience should that situation arise.
Because there's some wonderful contradictions about your character, which we can get into later. Which you know, I see you as a very joyful person. You know, when I've ever looked at interviews with you and seen you on stage doing that, and yet lyrically you can go to the darkest places. I think any British lyricist has been, and I just, you know, that tug and pull of that is interesting. But we should go back, Richard, if you don't mind, to.
Sure.
The beginnings of your influences musically, and because it's so diverse, much more diverse than most British rock players that we've spoken to.
Well, you know, I grew up in the house with you know, my father's records, which were mostly jazz and Scottish music. Interesting combination right there. And then my sister's records, my sister was 5 years older than me, and she was getting into rock and roll from the very beginning. So, you know, Bill Haley was in the house and Elvis was in the house. And then lots of Buddy Holly, lots of Gene Vincent, lots of Jerry Lee. And to me, that this was like an awakening, that this was music not just for teenage Brits, you know, who were rebelling against the kind of post-war depression almost. But it really spoke to me as well as like a 5 and 6 year old. I thought this music is fantastic. You know, the energy, you know, the message, you know, was so important. So I suppose I've ended up with this sort of synthesis of musical styles. You know, that there's a bit of jazz in there, there's a bit of rock and roll, and there's a bit of Scottish Celtic music in there.
Django.
Too. Yeah, Django's in there. You know, as well as, you know, Jimmy Shand and whoever you are as instrumentalist. You are that kind of sum total of your influences. And for me, Django Reinhardt. You know, which is my father's music, really. Les Paul. You know, we're never really on the front burner. It was just something in there. But it wasn't that important. The important stuff was, you know, Hendrix or you know. Listening to you know the birds or something, but I think it just crept in there, and you know there is this synthesis of styles that you know it's kind of unique to me, and I think every guitarist has their own unique synthesis. You know, Bert Jansch, Davy Graham, all these great acoustic players, Martin Carthy, you know, will have their own unique style, and it's what makes them special.
Your first electric guitar when you was a jazz guitar, wasn't it? You didn't go straight to like a Les Paul or
pretty much. I think I really liked the guitar player in Moby Grape, Jerry Miller, who had a big jazz Gibson, and I thought, well that's pretty cool.
Yes, 175.
Yeah, he gets a great tone out of that guitar, so perhaps that's what I should be doing. But after a while, it became a bit unwieldy for rock music, really. And I realized that a lot of my heroes, my guitar heroes, were actually Fender players, you know, people like Jimmy Bryant, James Burton, you know, where we're playing Fenders. I thought, well, that should be what I'm doing.
Your style with that flat picking, playing with the plectrum and your fingers, that you hit that right from the get-go, didn't you? That was...
I think so. It's something that I really did unconsciously, because I learned finger style. I learned classical finger style and also learned plectrum style. And I'd be sitting at home watching TV, you know, absentmindedly strumming away. And I realized that I was actually playing with my fingers and the thumb pick and the flat pick. I mean, sorry, at the same time. So, and that just developed as a thing without me thinking about it. It's weird. It's just out of laziness, really.
What you were saying about, you know, that post-war generation and your you know, your parents coming out of the war, you know, there was a sense of wanting order again in life. I mean, I sort of witnessed this. I'm younger than you, but, you know, it was, they wanted to be together. They wanted, you know, everything to be formal and ordered. And that caused the spark of the revolution, didn't it, really?
I think it really did, yeah. Plus, you know, you had the impetus of a boom generation, you know, the baby boomers. There were lots of them, you know, and culturally they really mattered. And that they continue to matter. I mean, right up to now, pretty much, you know, that they've influenced musical taste, they've influenced artistic taste all the way. Yeah, now, our parents went through a terrible time during World War II. And, you know, inevitably that they wanted to settle down after the war, you know, get a house, you know, raise a family, all that stuff. And you listen to, you know, to your parents' popular music from the early 50s or something. And it's all about, you know, 20 tiny fingers, 20 tiny toes, you know, those sort of songs, you know, it's about sort of raising a family and yeah. but it's kind of bland music, you know, the sort of the Elmer Cogan generation, you know.
Because you were in bands very, very young, weren't you?
I think that's probably from about age of 12, yeah.
With Hugh Cornwell,
yeah.
I mean, Hugh and I were great friends at school, you know, he wanted to play an instrument, so I taught him the bass, you know, and we had a little trio at school with Nick Jones, who was the son of Max Jones at the Melody Maker, but we had a little sort of power trio going, and that was great, and right until I started playing with the Fairport guys at about sort of 65, 66.
Did you stay in touch with him after that or throughout? Were you aware of it?
I really didn't. He went off to Scandinavia, I think, for a few years, and I was busy on the road. I didn't run into him for years and years and years. And then I think 40 years after our last conversation, I ran into him at a festival in Spain. And, hi, there you are. And we kind of, you know, picked up the conversation where we'd left it in 1967. And we've been in touch ever since, which is great.
And he played at your 70th, didn't he?
He did, yeah. Lovely.
That was a fantastic show. I've just been watching it on YouTube. Amazing.
It's hilarious. Well, we did a great version of Peaches just for fun, you know.
You gathered at this house, which was called Fairport, right, in Muswell Hill. Yeah.
Wait, has it got a blue plaque?
It hasn't
because
got a blue
it really
plaque, no.
Should have.
I went round there the other day and for this BBC thing, you know, and we knocked on the door and this guy says, oh yeah, you know, a lot of people come around here asking about the house, you know, and he said, you bought it probably just after we vacated actually, and he's been there ever since, and he said, yes, you know, the original owner was a guy called Dr. Munro, and my heart sort of stopped because there was a ghost at the house called Dr. Munro. Wow. You know, he was like haunting the house still.
How did you know his name?
Someone else spoke to him. It wasn't me, but someone else who was staying in the house spoke to this guy, and he was upset about the cat. Like he'd locked the cat in the cupboard or something, and the cat had died, and he felt guilty about that. So someone should go in
for eternity.
Well, yeah, or until someone goes in and exorcises him and gives him a bit of peace and quiet. But that was pretty interesting.
Muswell Hill had a sort of a scene, didn't it? You know, with Kinks came from up there as well.
Yeah.
Did you bump into them? Was that?
It's like that they'd already gone, but by the time that we were starting up, you know, I suppose we used to go and see the Kinks when they were called the Ravens. Local youth club, but really, you know, that they were, you know, a whole musical generation, like 4 years, 5 years ahead of us,
which is an eternity when you're that
age, it's an eternity,
it?
Exactly. so by the time we were gigging around, the Kinks had really moved on and were, you know, a very successful pop group and were playing like big places, you know, and we were playing at you know, Middle Earth or something.
Oh, listen, we have to talk about all that, but who did you want to be at that point? What band were you aiming for? Because I mean, obviously there's definitely a West Coast Americana that's already in your early music.
Yeah.
What was your ambitions?
Probably to be a band that focus on lyrics. We really love lyrics. You know, for us, it was really important when Dylan went electric. You know, the Byrds recording Mr. Tambourine Man, the Bells of Rhymney, things like that. We thought this is what we want to do. So we would cover songs by the great singer-songwriters, really. And at that time, that was Richard Farina, Phil Oakes. Early Joni Mitchell, we got hold of her acetates. The Dylan Basement tapes, we got hold of those. I think we were first to the
That's quite amazing to get hold of that stuff.
How?
Yeah.
We phoned up Dylan's publisher, man. We said, have you got any unpublished Dylan songs? He said, oh, yeah, come on over. And they gave us this pile of like 12 acetates of the Basement Tapes. And we did the same thing with Joni Mitchell. Before she'd made a record, we got hold of her demos from her publisher. We just phoned them up. It was easy.
Jumping ahead.
But that shows actually great kind of sort of initiative, though.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You looked in, didn't you have a little sneak into Joni Mitchell's lyric book at one point?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I did, yeah. We did a show with Joni at the Festival Hall when she was opening for us. I'm sure that never happened again. While she was on the stage, you know, I was walking past her dressing room and I just saw her notebook lying there. I thought, just have a little peek. Because I was really interested in other people's process, you know. You know, how writers write, you know, and it's something where you wrote standing up at the typewriter, you know, that kind of thing. That's what stuff really intrigues me. And so I just thought I'd get some insight into her process. And I suppose I did. I just thought that she was obviously like a very strong visual artist as well as a musical artist. And you could really see that in her writing and her doodles and stuff. Like just looking at a page of what she did was extraordinarily interesting, actually. Yeah.
Oh, of course, now you've just been able to get a picture on your phone.
Probably. Yeah.
That's a terrible thing. Sorry, I would never.
but covers were really where you were at that time then, wasn't it? You weren't seeing yourself as a songwriter with Richard at that point?
No, I mean, if we're talking 67, then we were a covers band, to the point where we thought, we need to write some songs because we noticed that in order to have credibility with the audience, you had to be writing at that point. I mean, you know, thanks to the Beatles, I think, more than anything else, the Beatles really changed the landscape. It used to be, you know, the writers wrote for the artists, you know, and the artists would perform. It was a separate thing in many cases. But when the Beatles came along, they did everything themselves. So, you know, the Stones had to start writing and all the other bands had to start writing their own stuff. So, you know, by 68, by our second album, we were pretty much writing at least half our albums at that point. And I suppose we didn't look back.
Now, there's something about these first two albums, I want to, which listening to them, because I think with the gigs you were playing, was your audience, you were playing folk clubs and stuff as well, weren't you? As well as just sort of straight.
Yeah. I mean, probably by 67, when we got an agent, we were just doing rock gigs. But certainly, you know, proto Fairport, you know, Fairport before it was called Fairport, we did a lot of folk clubs, you know, folk clubs, blues clubs. I mean, everything.
Because the thing is, those first two hours, especially the first one, listening to it now with everything else that was happening at the time, they sound so incredibly mature and assured and beautifully recorded, amazingly recorded. For the time, I mean, they're sonically fantastic, and I just wondered if you'd been playing to more of a folky audience, so rather than kind of manic pill popping mods or screaming girls, that kind of that gave you that more level approach to recording, because you know it sounds like it's like your sixth album or something. Anyway,
if I listen to the first album, it sounds to me all over the place, you know, stylistically. You know, there are so many threads, there are so many influences that it's almost too much. And by the second album, we're starting to iron that out a bit in a better way. I suppose the recording quality is down to John Wood, who is a wonderful engineer and a great
studio.
Who
stayed with you for so long, didn't he? You traveled with him.
I mean, he was the best, you know. And Sound Techniques is a really wonderful studio. And they also built their own mixing desks. So you had this really unique sound. And, you know, the mixing desks are changing hands for lots of money these days, you know, an original Sound Techniques desk.
You should talk about Joe Boyd, really, who's involved with this period and which season. And, you know, it's funny enough, because I'm reading your book, obviously it's all tied in, but it reminded me, because it deals in a particular corner of the music industry, which we're not always looking at.
Yeah.
And White Bicycle, I think, was Joe's book. Which I also, you know, really enjoy. So you've got the incredible string band, you've got Nick Drake, and this little cohort and a group of people that he's beginning to form. But also, let's talk about him as, you know, this is the the kid who fronted the UFO club and helped invent Pink Floyd and psychedelia. So just describe what's going on with Joe Boyd and that world.
Yeah. Joe was someone who always seemed to be in the right place at the right time, musically speaking. When he was at Harvard, he was booking people like Lonnie Johnson, Mississippi, Fred McDowell. He was bringing these blues artists up from Mississippi on the train, to play at Harvard. I mean, it was just ridiculous. He was the stage manager when Dylan went electric at Newport.
I didn't know that.
He was head of Elektra in the UK. This is when he's like 23 years old, which is pretty good. So he's running Elektra and he's recording the incredible string band for Elektra. He's telling Elektra, you should really sign this band called Pink Floyd. You should really sign this band called The Move. Elektra saying, no, I don't think so. No, we don't want to. Their loss, I think. and Joe, was probably, the only person in London who would have had the ears to really understand what Fairport were trying to do and what the Incredible String Band were trying to do. I mean, who else would have signed the Incredible String Band?
Yeah, they sound like an impossible proposition, the amount of people and...
They absolutely were. It's basically two of them, plus right. two girlfriends who'd play, anything from bass to finger cymbals and... And then they added dancers and it all got a bit out of control.
The best album front cover, I think, in the history of album front covers is that group of weirdos that's on the front, which in a way, I think you tried to slightly emulate in that gatefold of the album after Lesion Leaf.
I was the wrong way around.
Yeah,
and,
but that scene looked incredible, at that time.
Well, it's very much of its time, isn't it? I mean, it's an absolute bunch of hippies, and the Increds lived up in Edinburgh in this sort of almost like communal existence, and it was really a strange world up there,
But the UFO Club, that's
UFO Club, yeah.
I don't know where I'm connecting what Sid's doing lyrically and vocally with you guys who are doing, a more Americana, but it all seemed to work in the pot at UFO.
UFO, you had all the psychedelic bands. Family were a great band. Blossom Furs were a great band. And Pink Floyd were basically the house band at the UFO Club. Well, one of Fairport's early gigs, we'd only been in existence a couple of months, was to open for Pink Floyd. But that was the night that Sid pretty much left the band and the planet.
I think that your memory is either incredible or you have diaries from all that period, because some of the list of gigs and what went on is so detailed.
You've just taken your brilliant storytelling abilities from your songs and applied them to your life.
And I'm making it all up. Could be. My memory is very selective. I mean, some stuff, I'm sure, you might be the same, but you remember really, really clearly.
Yeah.
And other stuff, it is a blank. And I can compare notes with old band members from the 60s and say, do you remember this? And they'll say, no. And they'll say, do you remember this? And I'll say, no. really selective. The book would have been three times longer if I could remember everything. I did not keep diaries or journals. Alas, I wish to God I had. It would have made it so much easier. So I had to rely on websites that claim to have every Fairport gig that ever happened, claim to have, my old agent's books and stuff. But they're also incomplete. I mean, so it took a lot of gluing it all together.
But do you find that, because we've all written books here, find there's a thing of where you're convinced that, this was in Belgium on that week, and then you're told that it wasn't? You're like, yeah,
I found this all the time, actually. The people remembered things very differently, and I think you just have to trust your own memory, really. I'm pretty sure I'm right about most things.
I love this little shift that goes from where youth culture, pop culture goes from UFO to Middle Earth. And there is a kind of glimpse. I know Middle Earth is kind of known now as being the sort of birth of glam rock in a way. Yeah. Because, Bowie was there and T-Rex. Mm. And actually, if you look at that early Tyrannosaurus Rex, it's a guy singing with an English accent in a mystical way that has a spirituality about it that is kind of folky. They're sitting on the floor.
Yeah.
So there was this diversion at that point then, where some people went glam rock and others stayed in folk.
I think Mark Bolan was always, more in the pop world almost. I think he was a prime director. John's Children, which is his band, right. I think before T-Rex, we're more like a pop band. To T-Rex might have been just economics, where he said, okay, well, I'm just going to, two of us will play acoustic and we'll earn some money for a change. That may have been the motivation. I don't know. But
he was a mod. He would have been into show.
Yeah. I thought they were charming, I really liked him as a human being. I thought he was just a really nice guy, just a nice human being. And it was tragic to hear that he'd been killed. It really, really broke my heart.
Because one band that seems to come up a lot in your book, which I never really thought of as being, is The Social Deviants. that was Mick Brown, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, they were always around. And I think because they were very politically motivated, they'd be everywhere. They'd be at all gigs, they'd be at all benefits. You'd see them all over the place. And they were a very confrontational band. They were kind of
a sort of MC5 vibe.
Exactly, yeah. it was kind of, screw you, screw the audience, screw everybody. We're up here making a statement.
They were punk before punk.
In a sense they were, except that I think punk communicated something a bit clearer. I think the Deviants, as performers, the message got a bit scrambled,
Let's talk about, your second album, the Holidays album, and you suddenly writing this. How old are you now? You're only sort of 17, 18, 19.
19,
okay. Write Me on the Ledge, which is to this day, the Fairport anthem. It's still sung by thousands of people every year when they can go to festivals.
That's true.
What brought that on? It's one of the first songs you ever wrote, isn't it?
Well, I think it's the first thing I ever wrote solo. I'd probably written half a dozen songs as collaborations before that. I was just writing, something without thinking too much about what I was writing. I can interpret it now in various ways, but at the time I was just, stringing words together that sounded good. But there's obviously, there's some purpose behind the song. But as you say, I mean, people now sing it in this sort of anthemic way, and it's not my property anymore. It becomes somebody else's. I'm sure you've had the same feeling, Gary, where a song kind of goes out there and it's just, you don't own it anymore. People take it over and it's out there in the world. And if you wanted to change verse three, it's too late. It's gone.
Yeah, but I think actually what has made that song such a success is its ambiguity. People sing the funeral because they think, Meet on the Ledge is actually this place in heaven that we're all going to suddenly get back together again. But it's a sense, it's Meet on the Ledge doesn't really mean, it can mean a different thing to different people. It's about unity. It's about coming together as a group of people. We had Noel Gallagher on, and I think actually it's Wonderwall. Wonderwall doesn't mean anything either. But it's a sense, people all sing it together because you're my Wonderwall,
Meet
on the Ledge. That's part of the beauty of songs sometimes, is then they don't have to be totally detailed. They need to have that ambiguity of spirituality.
Well, I think absolutely. It's the poetical end of songwriting, if you like, that you can use language in a way that goes beyond logic, it goes beyond meaning, and that's the whole idea. It's great that particular song can be so open to interpretation. Yeah.
Can we talk about just meeting Sandy Denny? Because that was such a massive moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
and who was she? Because she's so iconic now.
She had a reputation on the folk scene as being this up and coming, singer songwriter. And when Judy left Fairport, we said, let's audition people, And Sandy was on the list. She was about number three or four on the list, and. After a couple of not very impressive auditioners, she came in and just lifted the roof off. I mean, she was such a great singer, in so many ways, a great singer. Great emotion in her voice, slightly elusive quality to a song. She could interpret a song very quickly. She could just nail a song, the intention of a song. One of the greatest singers I've ever heard, really.
And she auditioned you as well, didn't she?
Fair enough. I think, you know, because she was joining a band, she wanted to see, you know, the value of our music, see if there's something that she liked about us. So it was a kind of a mutual audition in the end. Yeah, that was great. But she was you know, fantastic musician, great songwriter, very original songwriter. And, you know, a bundle of contradictions as a human being, you know, like a bundle of nerves and you know, confident and not confident. Some men like went nuts over her, but she didn't want those. She wanted the other ones, you know. It's just a real mixture. God bless her.
Yeah.
Because what she brought in was more English folk and British folk.
Yeah.
And so that Unhalf Bricking album, that sort of kind of goes two ways. I mean, I know there's people fight all the time, you know, Legion Leave, Unhalf Bricking, that's the best one, this is the best one. But I think there's still, for me, there's that you're not quite clear on which direction you're about to go in at this point. You're still mm-hmm. half in Dylan's world and half in this old pre-industrial revolution world, you know. She brings that in, does she? Is it her gift?
We'd always played in folk clubs that we always, messed around a little bit with British traditional music. So it wasn't alien to us. But when Sandy came in the band, we didn't have a lot of rehearsal time. So, you know, she was trying to learn our repertoire, and we thought, well, we should learn some of hers. And then, you know, we'll have enough for a set. And so we kind of wrap ourselves around, you know, she moved through the fair, so things like that, Nottingham Town. And, you know, at some point on the Legion Leaf album, we're sitting backstage, you know, just messing around, and Sandy starts singing A Sailor's Life, of which I think she'd learned from Martin Carthy. And we said, well, that's a great song. You know, we could really do a nice arrangement of that, you know, because it's very droney. We can put a drone under it. And we can play something instrumental on it. So we said, well, let's just play it tonight without any rehearsal. We'll just get up on stage and we'll do it. And so we did that, and we thought, well, that went very well. Let's record it. And we recorded it in one take. And it's a kind of a magical take. It's one of those really lucky things that happens in the studio sometimes, where everything just clicks. And there are surprises for the people playing, you know, not just for the listeners, but as we're playing it, we're surprising ourselves all the time. We're thinking, well, that didn't happen before. Where did that come from? You know, all these little things keep kicking in. And to me, it's a really just a magical track that really cemented for us the idea that this should be the direction that Fairport goes in.
And it's a timeless track as well, because, you know, it doesn't sort of sit into, oh, that's very, sounds very late 60s. It doesn't say that now. It's has a modernity about it because of the drone, I think.
Whole period, yeah, those albums have dated fantastically. Well, I've been lost in Legion Leaf for the last couple of weeks, and I've forgotten. So it is a masterpiece. I mean, it's incredible.
I don't know about that, but anyway, thank you.
No? Oh, okay. you're ambivalent?
Oh gosh, yeah. With albums I've been involved in, always, yeah. Because there's things you think, well, we could have done that a bit better. Could have, you know, why did so and so do that there? You know, there's little things. I mean, I like the records generally overall, but I go more song by song. I think of almost like a 3 or 4 track album. You know, there are tracks on it that I could happily lose. They're almost like throwaway tracks, but there's absolutely great tracks on it. I think it's a 4 track LP in that sense.
An EP.
Yeah, absolutely. It would have been a monumental EP. And Legion Leaf, you know, I think, well, what if we'd done this song instead of that song? You know, there are things where I think we went kind of overboard on the really big ballads. We should have done a few smaller songs as well. I mean, Legion Leaf should have been a double album, really, because I think we had that much material.
Wow. I wish it was.
Yeah. Are there tapes?
Are there tapes? Nothing, no, zero. No.
It's one of the most horrific parts in the book. And I mean, you write, it's written like it's like Ian McEwan has made it up in a novel, but it's you've finished Unhalf Bricking in the studio and you're still doing gigs, and you come back from Birmingham one night, where I can't remember where you were, and this crash occurs. And the way it's described in the book, it's phenomenal. I mean, it's with your girlfriend, and you were sitting, you know, do you mind describing what what happened to you?
Yeah, sure. I really described it as it happened. I didn't really add or take anything away. I just tried to put in everything that I thought was pertinent, everything I could remember. Once the crash happened, I was in and out of consciousness a fair bit. So there are things that I was not aware of. It's this incredibly traumatic incident that really just about destroys the band. I mean, not quite, but almost completely destroys us. My girlfriend's killed, our drummer's killed, and we don't really know how we're going to carry on, how we're going to get the spirit to carry on.
So you were sitting in the front seat, right?
Yeah, I was in the front seat. I think I was the only one actually awake in the van, including the driver. The driver was asleep as well. So,
and people just didn't wear seatbelts as a rule, did you?
No. Nobody wore seatbelts. So, it took us a long time to recover from that. In a true, mental sense, I think it took us years to really get over the trauma. And you didn't go to therapy in those days. So there was none of that stuff.
Yeah,
it was kind of post World War II, where you've been through this thing, but stiff upper lip, carry on, chaps, and it'll all be okay. But we weren't okay. We were kind of broken, really.
Well, just getting in a van again, I would have thought was.
It was really difficult to get in a van and drive down the road. It was very hard. Yeah.
And you must think of Martin, quite often, really. He's there on the records. He's there in film.
And I'm so delighted that people have that ability to see Martin, and hear Martin play. I mean, that's his legacy. Is the 3 albums that he made with Fairport. And he was a wonderful human being and a great drummer, and it's just heartbreaking that someone like that should be taken away so young.
I wouldn't mind batting around a bit this kind of folk revival that happened, because it's so important. And I just put in my own personal 2 pence in. You may not realize it from the kind of music I ended up making, but it meant a lot to me in a certain period in my life. 1974, I went to a club quite often every week called the Florence. It was a pub off of Upper Street. And you went upstairs and you saw people with their fingers in their ears. You saw people with accordions and I listened to English folk music, and I found this book today. This I stole from my school library. It's the Oxford Book of Ballads.
Oh, wow.
There's Owen's school library. I'm going to get done for this. They're going to get in touch with me. And one of the first things I did as a songwriter, as a kid, was set these ballads to music. Wow. And I had no idea what the music was. I didn't read music. So, in here, I noticed this morning, and I remember when Legion Leaf came out, this Tamlin is in here and Sir Patrick Spence is in here. Yeah. And there was something going on in the air at that time. What was it?
Well, there have been cycles of revivals of British folk music. Starting with the Victorians, with like Cecil Sharp and people like Vaughan Williams going out in the field, because they really thought industrialization was going to kill folk music, or it was going to kill that whole rural way of life. So they were the first ones. Then you had in the 50s, you had Ewan McColl and A.L. Lloyd with the Ballad and Blues Club doing the kind of more of specialized arrangements and things of traditional song. But again, people were out in the fields collecting. Again, they thought it was going to
like
die
Lomax.
Out. Yeah, Lomax and Shirley Collins were out in the field. And Fairport were almost part of the third revival, the folk rock thing, which was bringing traditional music into the popular arena, with electric guitars, drums, all that kind of stuff. A constant through all that was probably, the folk clubs, which really got rolling in the early 50s. Probably in the 60s, there were, at least 300, maybe 600 folk clubs.
But there was a certain amount of politics behind it, I guess, as well. It was about working people, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. There's a very socialist sort of attitude to folk clubs. If you were the performer, you're kind of not treated as anything special. You were just just one of the crowd, who happens to sing.
Similar to in the way that the trad jazz scene was very political, wasn't it? And
I think the folk scene was more political than the trad jazz scene, actually. It was a real socialist / communist undertone to the whole thing, and that was the motivation for a lot of songwriters, and people saw traditional music as reflecting real working class values, in some cases true, in some cases misguidedly. But it was a big thing that was an undercurrent, really, that ran all through the 60s and 70s. They're still going, of course. It's less political these days, of course. And there were all types of folk clubs. You have folk clubs that were much more singer-songwriter. You had real hardcore traditional folk clubs, like the Singers Club in Hull, where you couldn't take in a musical instrument.
Finger to put in your ear.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, this was your this is your instrument. It's been a sort of a nurturing place for so many people as well. It was a great place to get up for the first time in front of an audience, and sing. So people got nurtured in that way. It's a great place for people like Billy Connolly, Jasper Carrot, to get started on a sort of show business career.
Because in fact, didn't you play it? Well, we're talking of open mic nights. Didn't you do the legendary open mic night in LA at the Whiskey? The Troubadour.
Yeah, the Troubadour. Yeah, I think we did a few of those actually over the years. Yeah, which was extraordinary. You'd see people like Peter Tork from the Monkees. We'd do a song, and Linda Ronstadt get up and do a song, pretty amazing sort of a high powered kind of open mic night at the Troubadour in those days. Gene Clark might get up and do a song. It's just extraordinary. Yeah.
But there's obviously a mass of contradictions in there. Obviously, you've got people with political ideals that are singing about people in fields pre-industrial revolution. And also, dare I say it was quite middle class to certainly in London, what I was.
Yeah, absolutely was.
But with Legion Leaf, do you think you were trying to invent a genre that would stop us all looking to America for our music?
I think that was the idea. That was absolutely the idea. We were a very idealistic band, a very thoughtful band, and we were a bunch of middle class intellectuals, really, when it comes down to it. But we really thought it was time that there was this kind of British popular music. The Kinks had kind of gone halfway there. The Beatles, to some extent, had gone a bit in that direction as well. But it was time to really make a statement, which the Legion Leaf album was. And that statement was echoed by bands in Scandinavia, bands in Holland, bands in Spain, who did the same thing with their tradition. So it was a very influential record.
But also because basically the whole folk rock movement in Britain spread out from Fairport Convention, didn't it? It was like all the players who sort of started there.
Pentangle.
All kind of came from you.
Well, I think so, yeah. I think because it was quite a small scene and a bit disconnected from the mainstream of popular music, you'd find yourself in a band with the same people over and over again. Like you'd leave one band and you'd be in one of the other four bands. There weren't that many, so you kind of revolve through the whole scene sometimes.
And we have ended up with one of the most sort of enduring festivals there is. With Crop Ready.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. They get 20,000 people on a good year, and have been going for years and years and years and years and years.
Yeah, the most terrifying musical experience of my life at Crop Ready.
What was that?
I had to get up, having never been in a room with, let alone rehearsed with, the Blockheads in front of 20,000 people and play "Hit Me with Your Rhythm Stick," which is the most difficult thing I've ever played in my life. Say thank God for a folk audience, because they were wonderful.
Forgiving.
It's tricky if you're the bass player.
Richard, it seems to me that crash kind of kept on reverberating, because you now make this incredible album, but people start to leave. Sandy leaves, and eventually you leave. Now you've got Swarbrick, and you're doing this electric jig stuff, which no one has ever done, reels and jigs and super fast stuff. It's unbelievable. But it still feels like the crash is still reverberating.
Yeah, I think it affected our decision-making a lot, I think we're in some kind of disarray, really. I don't think that Sandy would have left. I don't think Ashley would have left the band if it hadn't been for the accident, really. I think for a couple of years we were still, you know, not thinking straight.
But going solo was important to you.
Well, I think it was. You know, I've been in bands for a long time. I've been in bands since I was 12, and I think I was just burnt out with the whole band idea. And I wanted to get away, I think, just to write. And, you know, I left Fairport. I did a year just as a session guitar player, really. Played in Sandy's band a bit, played in Ian's band. But that left me plenty of time to write. And, you know, I wrote the songs that ended up on my first solo record.
Because you were a massive session player. Well, you did a lot of sessions.
Yeah, lots and lots and lots.
What's it? Henry the Human Fly, right? That's the one.
Yeah, that's the next one.
Which is a persona that you came up with when you were in Fairport. Was just a gag at the start of a show.
It was sort of a gag. Apparently, I made an entrance like you know where I swung in on a rope onto stage in a superhero costume, and. of which I remember absolutely nothing, as happens sometimes. But the guys from Fairport still call me Henry. They don't call me Richard.
Oh my god!
Wow.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get back to one story that made me smile in the book, and it kind of sums up all of you guys and maybe your shyness, really, Richard, is that when McCartney invites you to his birthday.
Oh, yeah.
And you turn it down.
Yeah, I know. If I could have take two on that one, I think I'd go. Yeah, I don't know what I was thinking. I thought the Beatles were a bit too pop, you know, and I was obviously a bit of a snob musically. So I thought, well, you know, it's only Paul McCartney. You know, if it was Dylan, I'd go. You know, if it was some, you know, more of a wordy singer songwriter, I'd probably go. But
why were you invited?
I don't know.
You were still quite very cult at this point, weren't you?
I got invited. Sandy got invited, and no one else in the band. I think that they were.
That's even worse.
Yeah, that is even worse, isn't it? I think that there must have been, you know, going through a list of you know, sort of who's who or who isn't on the on the London scene.
You may have been a snob, but I see it more as being fearful of celebrity.
Probably also true. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What happens to you now is you find the Sufi form of Islam, right?
Islam.
Yeah.
You find that, and you meet Linda. That really changes your life. I mean, are you still a Sufi, Richard?
Yes, I am. Yeah, I still do all that stuff. Yeah, for me, looking at the music business, I see these kind of forks in the road where you say, okay, I'm gonna die of an overdose if I go this way, or I clean up completely and I get some spiritual value in my life. You know, so for me, it was that kind of choice, kind of stark thing.
Being part of this, you know, you're trying to process all this, and suddenly you have some clarity here. You have order, because that's what religion gives you.
Yeah, yeah.
When you know, music business is completely disordered.
Yeah, I think I needed some kind of way to steer through, you know, the shark infested waters of the music business, if you like. You know, yeah, clarity is a good way of putting it. But, you know, I wanted some connection with the universe. I wanted to know where I was in it, what my place in it was.
Yeah, I know. I've heard you say this about all music being spiritual. And I'm trying to just get the definition of that word, because the cynic in me is pulling it down. Mm. And I want to believe that. And I know, as a writer and as a singer, when I'm immersed in a song, I'm not in this room. You know,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Is that sort of what you mean? It's about finding a higher self.
I think so. And I think the way you find a higher self is by losing yourself. You know, so when you lose yourself in music, you become a part of this greater thing, this sort of semi-conscious part of this greater thing. Your ego gets suppressed a bit somehow, and you kind of open up and you feel all these connections. You know, how do you describe music? Music's so elusive. You know, you can't grasp it. You can't get hold of it. Yeah, you can't paint it. You can't, you know, stick it in a box or something. Yeah, you can't hold it in your hand. Mm-hmm. It's this stuff that's kind of out there and drifting around. You know, in that way, it's the closest to escaping, you know, the earth, if you like. You know, escaping earth, the earth and earthly values.
What do you think the secret is to that album you made with Linda? You know, I Want to See the Bright Lights. I mean, is that what is it that makes that? Because I love that album. You know,
yeah.
It's always in people's, often in people's top 10 best albums.
I don't know. I think sometimes you just get lucky. I think that's all it is. You know, sometimes that, you know, the stars line up and you go in the studio and everything works and you know, the tracks go down easily. You know, you're not struggling for days to get, you know, a good rhythm track or something. Everything just worked the first time, and I think the songs were good. He said modestly, and I think the performances are good. And everything we tried worked. You know, all the people that we brought into the record, you know, like Crumhorn players and you know
the Silver Band. You say Silver Band rather than Brass Band.
Yeah, I mean, it's a minor distinction, but you know they usually call you know, like works bands, like colliery bands or steel works bands are usually silver bands because they're playing, you know, silver instruments rather than brass instruments.
But that has a mournful sound to that as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's this real mournful, nostalgic sound to it, which is kind of wonderful.
Although, actually, on that song, it's actually very bright and up-sounding, that band. It's not the downness one associates with a brass band, you know.
It's bright and up-sounding with a tinge of melancholy.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, I hate to say this because this sounds flippant, but that you were kind of the Lindsay and Stevie of England, weren't you, Bill, at that point? There was, and I mean that in a good way. I mean, that's brilliant. On the record. And I think having a glimpse into the relationship made it real, you know.
It's funny because you don't necessarily think you're writing songs about your relationship, especially if you're a performing couple, you know, because that would be too naked and too self-conscious, really. So you just write these songs and you think, oh, that's a kind of love song, you know, that's a song of loss, you know, blah blah blah. But you don't think it's about you. I wish we had the financial recompense of Lindsay and Stevie.
By the time you get to Shoot Out the Light, I mean, that makes Rumours seem just like a little corner, doesn't it? it's a great record, and it was a struggle to get it out, I know, but you stop in the book and you don't describe what, you know, historically is now known as the Tour from Hell. You don't describe that.
Yeah.
Does that feel just too personal, Richard, when you and Linda go on tour and she's having to sing songs that you've written about your relationship failing?
Yeah, I mean, it's also bizarre, isn't it? I wanted to stop in 75, but because, you know, I thought 76 not that interesting, 77 to 80 not that interesting. And if I was going to pick it up again, it would be in 81 with the Tour from Hell. Do I have the stomach for writing that? I don't know. Maybe someone else should write it, or I could write it, I suppose.
Or Linda.
Yeah. perhaps we'll write it jointly or something. But you know, if you like it in, you know, in my career, that's the next interesting point is 81. But then from then on, things spread out. You know, the reason I was happy to write about 67 to 75 is such a compressed time period, and so much happened in that period. It seems, you know, like 69, we had like three albums out. I mean, how do you do
that? Yeah, I know. That is an insane thing. How did that even happen?
I don't know. It's nuts, you know.
Yeah.
We just recorded all the time, I think, basically. If I did another volume, it would take like 20 years to have the same number of pages, if, in a sense, you know, because just the first time you do something, you know everything's very alive and you're very awake to it. You know, the 15th time you're playing Scunthorpe, you think, well, what am I going to write about? But the, you know, the first time, you know, things happened and you remember it. I do remember the first time playing at Scunthorpe, not being able to get into the venue because I didn't have a tie on. but I'm performing here this evening. I don't care who you are. Sorry, you haven't got a tie on. You're not getting in here.
You find your voice in the end, which is this wonderful baritone, but you sing in an accent that it's difficult to discern it, but it is definitely English, British sounding accent. Yeah. There's elements of the north of England in there. There's certainly elements of where you grew up in London. That's all in this vocal. You go to America to live again and allow American music to come back into your life, but filtering it through these things that you've discovered about British folk music.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the aim of Fairport was always to be something of a synthesis, to take elements from rock music and to put the traditional stuff into that as well. We were always applying, there's all a little bit of, American style in the drumming, that there's always the backbeat there, as opposed to, a Scottish dance band drummer.
Because magnificent rhythm section, always.
Absolutely fantastic. I mean,
magnificent.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm privileged to have worked, my whole life with exceptional musicians.
Yeah,
because Maddox is
Maddox and Peg,
incredible,
fantastic. Yeah,
they
are really great musicians, I'm so lucky to have fallen in with musicians with such great, first of all technique, but then feel, just really great feel, which is a rare thing.
Tell us about your songwriting, Richard, because as I said at the beginning, you're very light and jovial and witty and all those things that maybe you weren't when you were a younger man, and maybe you were a lot shy, but your music can go to places that, is incredibly dark. Is that you, or is that something that is in subconsciously you, that you dig deep for when you're writing?
I think it's a matter of digging. No, but I've always been a kind of optimistic art person. Even when I was a kid, surprisingly, I wasn't a depressed teenager. I like to think I was, but I actually wasn't. I think as a writer, sometimes you do have to dig deep to find that place where there's human commonality. So that when you sing a song from that place, other people in the audience can say, oh, I've been there, or that speaks for me. To me, that's a very important thing, is to be able to communicate, humanity to other human beings. If the music seems a little dark, that's just the tradition I come out of. You look at all those ballads, those traditional Scottish ballads, and it's kind of dark stuff,
Always someone getting killed, wasn't there?
There's always somebody getting killed.
She's always burying him by the roadside, isn't she?
Exactly. Always, all the time. That's just, the kind of language that I grew up with. It's like, if you grew up with the Louvin brothers in America, that you'd probably be expressing the darker side of country music. It's a thing, but it doesn't mean people don't like it. People appreciate it.
Yeah.
When you sing those songs, people can really empathize with what you're singing about.
Because we live most of life in denial, and at times with art, and the communication of that, we think, well, I'm not the only one feeling weird about all this.
Yeah. But that isn't to say that the music should not also be uplifting and joyous, yeah, and have lots of choruses. And if I could write more of those, I'd be very happy to.
It's been a massive pleasure and honor to talk to you.
Absolute honor for me too. Thank you so much, really. It's so nice to meet you both virtually, and hopefully one day in the flesh.
Oh, that was fantastic.
I mean, I'm slightly fallen in love with him in that last hour. He's such a nice guy, isn't he?
Yeah, I'm afraid it showed, Gary. It's a little awkward.
I'll
send an email. I'll clear everything up.
Me and you are just going to end up like Richard and Linda ended up. I'm going to get out of it. I'm going to go and make a divorce album about you, Guy.
Yeah, the next year's Sources is going to be the tour from hell.
Follow that, as they say. Thank you for everyone who's been so kind about our show on the internet and left nice things.
Yes, and thank you for listening. Keep listening. Thank you to Ben. And we'll be back with someone who hopefully as brilliant.
Yes, yes. And it's good night from me.
And good night from her.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.